for our Thursday morning Tehillim class, an infusion of spirituality, a fusion of motivation to get us ready as we enter into the back end of the week, as we get ready for Shabbos. And of course, tonight is the eighth night of Chanukah, what we refer to as Zos Chanukah. And so I was trying to think of a chapter of Tehillim that we have not yet studied that we could, that would relate to Chanukah. And somehow chapter 80 of Tehillim came up. And so I started learning chapter 80 of Tehillim, and I don't think it has anything to do with the holiday of Chanukah. And yet, it's perfect for the parshias that we find ourselves in, and I will explain that as we go through it. So again, I want to welcome everyone. Thank you for joining me. If anyone's interested in sponsoring a future Tehillim class, please be in touch with either me or the shul office. And for those of you that are joining us not from Boca and are in colder climates like I am, hope everyone's staying warm today. If not from the heat in your house, than from the warmth of the Torah that we are going to study here this morning. So again, I hope that everyone is doing really well. Okay, we are going to study chapter 80 of Tehillim, Perek Bei, And let's jump right in. The chapter says, L'manatzeach al shoshanim edus la'asaf mizmor. Now the shoshanim here, as the Meforshim point out, is talking about the Jewish people, right? Kishoshanim bein achochim, like a rose amongst the thorns. And obviously that's describing, and it automatically, right off the bat, cues you in that we're talking about the Jewish people in respect to exile. And as I'll show you in a minute, as we go through it, both Rav Hirsch and the Malbim and the Rashi and the Radak, they all understand this chapter of Tehillim as referring to a chapter of Tehillim having to do with the Jews in exile. So let's just break this chapter down. Now that we read the introductory pasuk, we already saw the word Shoshanim, which shows us that it's referring to the Jews vis-a-vis the world around them, vis-a-vis the nations around them. And this chapter of Tehillim from here on out is spread out into three parts. First, you have verses 2 to 3, which is a call out to Hashem. Then you have 5 through 7, which is essentially a claim against Hashem. Ad matai, Hashem, how long are you going to allow all this to go on? And lastly, 9 through 19 is a mashal. It's a parable where the Jewish people are going to be compared to a vine, a grapevine. And essentially what it's saying is, Hashem, you have saved us in the past. We are in difficulties now. So we're davening to you for Hashem that you should continue to save us in the future going forward. Now, if you're doing math, you'll notice that I said 2 through 3, 5 through 7, and 9 through 19. That's not because I'm really bad at math, although I happen to be really bad at math. I did not accidentally, leave out Psukim 4 and Pasuk 8. And the reason is because one of the things that makes this chapter of Tehillim unique is that there is a refrain. There's a pizmon that's going to appear three times in this chapter of Tehillim, where essentially we ask Hashem to return us to Him and to manifest His salvation upon us. And what's interesting about that, and all the Meforshim point that out, is that that pizmon, that refrain, which appears three times in this chapter of Tehillim, is there to break up our chapter into three parts. And so therefore, for example, Rav Hirsch, who we're going to get to in just a little bit, Rav Hirsch explains that this chapter of Tehillim is referring to three different and distinct and exiles. And that therefore, this chapter is a tefillah to Hashem on behalf of the Jewish people when it is being threatened by our enemies, when we are being threatened by our enemies. And essentially what this chapter of Tehillim says is that we describe how good Hashem was us to us in the past. We complain about the hardships that we are currently going to, and we dive into Hashem that He should remove those hardships from us going forward. Now, let me read Rav Hirsch for you in his introduction to this chapter of Tehillim, because Rav Hirsch, I think, gives a very compelling argument about this chapter of Tehillim, and we're going to contrast it with the Malbim's interpretation of this chapter of Tehillim. So Rav Hirsch off the bat picks up on this word Shoshanim, which again is like a thorn amongst the roses. It's talking about the Jewish people vis-a-vis our relationship with the nations around us, specifically when we are going through exile. And Rav Hirsch points out that if you notice the three sections that we are going to read in chapter 80 of this Tehillim, that the length of our description of Hashem is going to increase each section. So section 1, let's just look, right? Go to Pasuk 4 for a second. Pasuk 4 says, Elokim hashiveni ve'aer panecha v'nivashea. Right, again, 2 and 3 is our call out to Hashem. And then we say, Hashem, hashivenu, lead us back, Ve'er panecha v'nivashea, and bestow, shine your light on us so that we shall be saved. Now if you go to verse 8 for a second, and in verse 8 you have the exact same pizmon, you have the exact same refrain, only you'll notice that there's one noticeable difference. Although I wouldn't have noticed that, but that's why we have Torah giants like Rav Hirsch to point it out for us. You notice it says, Elokim tzvakos hashivenu ve'er panecha v'nivashea. Right? Whereas in Pasuk 3, it just says Elokim. Here, it's Elokim tzvakos. We now use a longer description of our relationship with Hashem. And then finally, if you go all the way to Pasuk 20, Pasuk Chaf, at the end of this chapter of Tehillim, you'll notice that it says, Hashem Elokim Tzvakos Hashivenu Ha'er Panecha V'nivashea. So most of the words are exactly the same, with one exception. And that is that the name employed to describe Hashem grows incrementally as we progress through this chapter of Tehillim. So we start with Elokim, then we go to Elokim Tzvakos, then we go to Hashem Elokim Tzvakos, which is going to be the longest description of that relationship with Hashem. Says Rav Hirsch, this is not accidental, but it's actually reflective of these three exiles that we are going to talk about. And so exile number one, Psukim 2 and 3, says Rav Hirsch, is referring to the 10 lost tribes. 10 lost tribes, of course, we know that in the time of Yeravam, and we're going to talk about this a little bit more, those who remember all the way back, when we studied all of Sefer Melachim together over 2 years. So you'll remember that the tribe, that the house of Israel, that the Jewish people were divided into two. You had Rehavam in the south, Yeravam in the north, and Yeravam divides the Jewish people. So after that, those 10 tribes up north, right down below is Malchus Yehuda, up top is Malchus Yosef, which is going to be very important for us as we progress in this shiur today. So in Malchus Yisrael, the 10 northern tribes, those become the 10 lost tribes. Says reverse, those 10 lost tribes, by the time they are expelled from the land of Israel, they are largely assimilated. They are estranged from Jewish life in the spirit of Judaism, even while they still constitute an independent kingdom. In other words, they were living in the land of Israel. But there came a time when they were basically completely estranged from any relationship with Hashem and from any connection with the Jewish people. When they were driven into exile, in which they disappeared into oblivion, right, that's why they're called the 10 lost tribes, because they are lost, and part of the whole machlokes, in the Gemara we've given shiurim about this, is are they lost forever, right? The Gemara has a machlokes about whether they are ever going to return, or whether they are not going to return. And obviously for religious Zionists, this carries enormous significance, because for many religious Zionists, we believe that the resurrection of these 10 lost tribes, or the return of these lost tribes, actually foreshadows or signifies the coming of Mashiach, the ultimate redemptive process. And that's why in Israel, obviously, the return of Ethiopian Jewry and the tribes of from India and etc., right? Obviously, those are important because we're saving Jews and we believe they are Jews. But for religious Zionists, for so many in Israel, it represents something far greater. It represents Kibbutz Galios. It represents the gathering of these 10 lost tribes as the harbinger of the ultimate redemption. And so says Rav Hirsch that when these 10 tribes disappeared into oblivion, they were already estranged from their relationship with Hashem. But they remained human beings nonetheless. And therefore, their call to God is addressed as Elokim, as judge. Right? The word Elokim, says Rav Hirsch, denotes a relationship in which Hashem has with every human being, into which any man who has been a victim of abuse has the right to appeal. So Elokim is the most generic description of our relationship with Hashem. It does not require you to be a Jew. It does not require you to be faithful or to maintain a fidelity necessarily to Hashem. But if you feel that you are a victim of abuse, injustice, so you call out to Elokim, that's why in that first verse, of Pasuk 4, it says Elokim Hashivanu, because we're talking about the exile of the 10 lost tribes. Then we come to the second one, which is going to be verse 8, which is going to be the culmination of that second exile. That second exile is referring, says Rav Hirsch, to the Babylonian exile, right? Which is the banishment of the Jews, even those Jews who were in the two southern tribes, Malchus Yehuda, okay, which is Binyamin and Yehuda. And there, Rav Hirsch says that those who were exiled to Babel had gone into banishment as Jews, right? In other words, they didn't go into banishment estranged from Hashem. they were bona fide card-carrying members of the Jewish people, and yet they went into exile. And even in an alien land, and in the midst of the most excess of idolatry, in the collapse of their independence, right? Nonetheless, they had the right to think of themselves once again as Tzvakos Hashem, right? What is Tzvakos? Tzivos Hashem, right? What's Tzvakos? It's a special group amongst all the other groups of creatures of Hashem's command, right? It's essentially Hashem's army. And so in the first one, it's just Elohim, because we're referring to Hashem in generic phraseology. God is just the universal God. He is the judge over anybody, irrespective of whether you have a relationship with him or not. When we come to the second exile, Bavel, there we went into exile as Jews. And so we have the right to refer to Hashem or to relate to Hashem as Tzvakos Elohim, right? We are your army, Hashem. We have a unique, special relationship with you. Banim Atem LaHashem Elokeichem. And then you come to the third one. And the third one is Hashem Elohim Tzvakos. We add on Yudke Vavke. There, of her says, we are not talking about the 10 lost tribes that were thrown out by Assyria. We're not talking about the Babylonian exile. Rather, we are talking about the third exile under which we currently find ourselves, which is called the Roman exile. And the third says, refers to the third exile, however, begun under the triumph of Rome's destructive might, destroyed every vestige of Israel's national independence, and caused it to be dispersed to all the lands of the earth. This exile was to be the indeterminate donation, excuse me. Therefore, this last and longest exile of all could indeed easily be interpreted as a sign of the utter disappearance of the phenomenon of Israel in the world of history, right? One could very easily look at the last 2,000 years of Jewish history and say, God has forsaken his people. That the unique relationship that always existed between Hashem and Klal Yisrael is no longer. And by the way, that's not a far-fetched idea. We know that religions of the world have tried to argue that. They've tried to argue that the Old Testament represented an outdated covenant between God and the Jewish people. But with the New Testament, God has chosen a new people. God has abandoned, so to speak, the Israelites. And the proof is in history. Because if we really are God's chosen people, and if we really are Banim Atem LaHashem Elokeichem, how could God have treated us this way throughout history? And so they argue it must be that God had abandoned the Jewish people and that he has chosen someone new. Right? That is a very logical interpretation of the last 2,000 years of exile. Says Rav Hirsch, therefore, appeal is now made to the significance of Israel's role in the eventual salvation of all mankind. Right? We are appealing to Hashem and saying to Hashem, we are the cog, we are the epicenter of the ultimate salvation of mankind. When Israel cries out to God for deliverance from this third Roman exile, it therefore beseeches God to help because he is Hashem Elokei Tzvakos. Hashem refers to Hashem's name in the context of the eventual redemption. And so says Rav Hirsch, what you see here, and it's really, I think it's a beautiful interpretation, says Rav Hirsch here, you see an evolution that's playing out throughout our chapter of Tehillim. You see an evolution in exiles, going from the 10 lost tribes to Galus Bavel, to the Roman exile that we currently find ourselves in. But for me, I think it represents something even more profound, which is it's not just the exiles, right? It's a description of the increasing intensity of our exiles. But I actually think it's beautiful because it refers to a unique relationship that all of us have with Hashem, which is that our relationship with Hashem is not monolithic. It is not static, but it evolves. And so there are times when we refer to Hashem simply as Elohim, right? Hashem, I don't feel like there's anything unique about me, right? We may have forsaken and abandoned you, and yet I still maintain a relationship with you. It says Tzvakos. And then there are times when we're Jews and we go down as Jews and we fight as Jews. And that's when we refer to him as Elohim Tzvakos. Hashem, we are your army. We are your chosen people. I'm relating to you now in a very different sense, in a very different context. And by the end, it's Hashem Tzvakos Elohim. Because again, our relationship with Hashem has evolved throughout this chapter of Tehillim. For those of you who remember Rabbi Dov Zinger, who came to BRS last year right before COVID hit the fan. In fact, if you remember, right after he was here, he went to New Rochelle afterwards for a Shabbos, and he contracted COVID in New Rochelle, went back to Israel, had to quarantine in Israel, and it obviously created waves because he had gotten in New Rochelle and people were worried that he got it here. But if you remember, if you've ever read his books, and I really recommend it, he has this amazing sefer on tefillah called Ve'ani Tefillati. It's been translated into English, although I don't think the English translation fully does it justice, but it's better than nothing. And it's a whole sefer about his bodhidus, about relating to Hashem, about how to make our conversations with Hashem authentic and meaningful. And in that context, one of the things he speaks about is relating to Hashem in different ways. Right? If you think about how you enter into your Shmoneh Esrei, so depending on your emotional state at that moment in time, depending on what you're going through that day, the trials, the tribulations, the ups and the downs, whatever it might be, you are going to relate to Hashem differently in that Shmoneh Esrei than you might have in the previous Shmoneh Esrei or in the next Shmoneh Esrei. So for example, if I'm having a great day and everything is clicking on all cylinders, my davening this morning was great and my learning was great, so I might relate to Hashem as a father to a son, someone who's loving, someone who's caring, someone who puts his arm around me. On the other hand, if I'm going through a very difficult time in my life and it feels like Hashem has abandoned me, so I'm obviously not going to utilize necessarily that imagery of an Av, but I might have one as a Melech, as a king, right, which is much more of a cold type of connection. I serve the king. I don't really have a choice in it. I do it because it's my obligation. I might refer to Hashem as a Dayan Ha'emet, right? God is a judge. And what that means essentially is, again, I think even a colder version of that relationship. The point being is that each one of us, when we enter in Shmoneh Esrei, Rav Zinger challenges you to first and foremost think about how you're going to relate to Hashem in the Shmoneh Esrei, right? Where am I at emotionally that I'm relating to Hashem? Because that really serves as the backdrop upon which my entire conversation can take place. If I want the conversation to be authentic, right? Let's take an example. Let's even take a spouse, right? Not every time you talk to your spouse is it going to be the same way, right? Some days, and I know this is hard to understand, some days you feel closer, some days you feel more distant. You may have gotten in an argument, You may have had a disagreement, you might be an anniversary, right? There are lots of things that can go on in a relationship which will dictate the nature of that relationship. That's the same thing with Hashem, right? Sometimes we relate to Hashem as a father. Sometimes we relate to Hashem as a king. Sometimes I relate to Hashem as a judge. Sometimes I relate to Hashem as a warrior, right? Hashem ish milchama. We have lots of different descriptions of Hashem. And so when I come into my Shmoneh Esrei, I have to know, like, on what terms am I engaging Hashem? Because that's the only way to make it authentic. It's not a Sefer on Tehillim, it's a Sefer on Tefillah. It's Rav Dov Zinger, and it's called in Hebrew, Ve'ani Tefillati. It's put out by Magid, I believe. But you can just Google it and it'll come up there. Okay? So why am I going into this whole parenthetical comment about Rav Zinger and the different ways we approach Hashem? Because I think that's this chapter of Tehillim, right? As we progress through the chapters of Tehillim, we represent that through different descriptions of Hashem. Because as we change, we relate to Hashem in different ways as well. And so, all of that was a really big backdrop to Rav Hirsch's interpretation of our chapter of Tehillim. Now, I promise to do the Malbim as well, and I also promise you we'll actually get to the actual chapter of Tehillim. Malbim says, before you understand this chapter of Tehillim, you have to understand the backdrop to this chapter of Tehillim. And again, for those who have been attending my classes for many years, you are going to know this very well. Says the Malbim in his introductory comments to this chapter of Tehillim, he says, Mizmor zeh yasduha b'nei Asaf b'mei Ezra. This chapter of Tehillim is referring to the times of Ezra and Nehemiah. Sheshavu min ha-gola v'ratzu livnos ha-heichel. Right, that they wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash. So let's take a little bit of a tour through history. Right, the first Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. I don't know my exact dates here. 580-something, 584, 586, 585, something around there. Okay, the exile lasts for 70 years. Okay, and we know that number 70 is going to be significant because according to Chazal, one of the reasons why Ahasuerus is making a whole big party is because according to Ahasuerus' calculations, the 70 years were up. and God hadn't yet redeemed the Jewish people. He hadn't yet returned them and rebuilt the Beis HaMikdash. And so Achashverosh took out the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash. He took out the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash, and he throws a whole party to show God is not going to return the Jewish people to the land of Israel. And everyone starts clapping. And now you understand the meaning of the Gemara. When it says, you know what the sin of the Jewish people at the time of Purim, Purim, by the way, being the next Jewish holiday, right? You know what the sin of the Jewish people was? Shenena misudaso shel Achashverosh, that they benefited from the suda, from the party that Achashverosh held. And all the mefarshim wonder, what was so bad about the party? Is that a kashrus thing? Is it a promiscuity thing? Like, what exactly bothered Chazal so much about the party? Clearly, they had done other things wrong. But now you understand in the context. If the whole party was celebrating that the Beis HaMikdash was not rebuilt, and that God had clearly abandoned the Jewish people, then the Jews participating in that party is really egregious. And it paints it in a totally new light. Anyways, the Jews, at the end of the 70 years, Koresh, Cyrus, the king of Persia, gives the Jewish people permission to return to the land of Israel. Of course, it's not Ezra and Nehemiah who come back first. It's Zerubbabel and Yoshua. We've studied this. In fact, for those who paid attention last week, so you'll remember that the Haftorah from Zechariah, I believe. I hope I got that right. But Haggai and Zechariah are prophesizing about the exact same time. Yes, Zechariah with his menorah, but it's prophesizing about the exact same time. Haggai and Zechariah are the Nevi'im at the time. Yoshua and Zerubbabel come back in the first Shivat Zion, the first attempt to return. And then Ezra and Nehemiah come a little bit later. And if you remember the story, and if you haven't, open up a Tanakh and read the story, because the books of Ezra and Nehemiah are the singularly most relevant books of Tanakh to the time and place that you and I are living in, the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. And you'll remember that when they come back, who gets in their way? The enemies step forward and they try to interrupt the building of the Beis HaMikdash. And when Nehemiah comes and he tries to build the walls around Yerushalayim, they come and they try to interrupt that. And you'll remember the names of Sanballat and Tuvia, who are the enemies. The first use is really the words Aravim, they're Arabs, Geshem. And they come and they try to interrupt the building of the Beis HaMikdash. They write letters back to the Persian kings and saying, these Jews aren't doing it for any good reason. They're doing it because they want to rebel against you. They're building the walls around Yerushalayim to fortify themselves so that they can rebel against you and wage war against you. And it's only when Ezra and Nehemiah reaffirm their loyalty to the Persian king that he allows the building of the Beis HaMikdash to go forward. Says the Malbim, that is the story that's the backdrop to this chapter of Tehillim. He says that when Ezra and Nehemiah came back, ve'oivim ratzu lihilachem otam ulahashbis melachtam, when the enemies wanted to fight against them and they wanted to cease, they wanted to stop the building of the Beis HaMikdash, v'ayu az anim umarodim, V'yidme shivatam mibavel neged shivatam mimitzrayim. And what do? We contrast the redemption from Bavel, in other words, our return to Yerushalayim, with the redemption from Mitzrayim. And therefore, we're going to argue to Hashem that the same way, Hashem, you saved us from Mitzrayim, we daven to you to save us from Galus Bavel, to return us safely to the land of Israel, to not let the Nudniks get in the way and to interrupt the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. That is introductory point number two. Introductory point number three, and with this I promise we're actually going to get to the chapter of Tehillim. Introductory comment number three is, you'll notice in verse two, so actually let's start reading. So we started off, L'manaseach al shoshani medus le'asaf mizmor. And then, what do we say? Ro'e Yisrael ha'azina Noheg Katzon Yosef Yoshev HaKruvim Hofia. Ro'e Yisrael, right, the shepherd of Israel, Hazina, pay attention, Noheg Katzon Yosef, you who shepherded us, who led us, who led Yosef, led the flock of Yosef, Yoshev Kruvim, you who appear or enthrone yourself in the Kruvim, Hofia, appear to us. Now you'll notice the word Yosef, immediately and off the bat. And then in Pasuk 3 it says, Lifnei Ephraim uVinyamin uMenashe Orerat Gvuratecha. Before at the head of Ephraim and Binyamin Menashe, arouse your might. Lecha lishuascha lanu. And come to our assistance. Come to our help. What do you notice immediately about Psukim 2 and 3? You have Yosef, you have Ephraim, you have Binyamin, and you have Menashe. This is obviously significant because you have three of Rachel's Shvatim: Ephraim, Menashe, Binyamin, and obviously Yosef. What is the significance of that? And so I refer you back to what we said earlier. You have to remember that in the time of Yeravam, the Jewish people were split into two. And you had the 10 northern tribes, which is referred to as Malchus Yisrael. And you had the two southern tribes, which is Binyamin linking itself to Yehuda, which is referred to as Malchus Yehuda. And that was the split. That was the split in the time of Yeravam. And unfortunately, that split lasted until even the two southern tribes disappeared as well. If you remember from the Haftorah in Parshas Vayishlach, I believe it's the end of Avadia, it describes how the reunification of these two contingencies of Malchus Yehuda and Malchus Yisrael, or Yosef, when they are going to be reunited, that is what is going to symbolize the ultimate bringing of Geula, which is why, think about it, how many Mashiachs are there going to be? There are two Mashiachs. There's Mashiach ben Yosef, and there's Mashiach ben David, right? They both have to happen because it's the unification of the two of them, which is ultimately going to be the building of the Beis HaMikdash. And so many of the Mefarshim point out, why are we referencing these Shvatim here? Right? Why are we referencing Lifnei, Ephraim, Menashe, Binyamin, right? Ketzon, Yosef. What do all these tribes have to do with here? So again, if we're talking about pleading to Hashem to return us from the exile, so one of the ways that we do that is by davening that these tribes should once again be united, that there shouldn't be a bifurcation between Ephraim, Menashe, Yosef in the north, and Binyamin and Yehuda in the south. Rather, there should be the unification of them. And that's why, again, I think that is significant and important. I'll just point out that Rav Hirsch notes here that the word Yosef, right, whenever Klal Yisrael is referred to as Yosef, it is a designation for the Jewish people as a whole. It indicates Israel's role in world history, in its relationship to the outside world. It denotes the ideal Jew, one who, like Yosef, faithfully preserves his Jewish spirit and maintains his Jewish way of life, even in his association with the non-Jewish world, one who commands recognition of his way of life from the outside world, and who says, Eich aseh arazos v'hachatasi lalukim. So every time we see the word Yosef, it's in the context of our relationship vis-a-vis the world around us, essentially what we're, the same way Yosef was able to be in Mitzrayim, and nonetheless maintain his fidelity to his roots, to his tradition, to his Mesorah, to his relationship with Hashem. So when Klal Yisrael is referred to as Yosef, it's that type of relationship as well. The Malbim points out over here in Pasuk 2, the Malbim says, Ro'e Yisrael Hazina. He says, Shebizmana Avar Ha'isa Ro'e Osam, U'male Kol Tzor Hecheyem. In the past, you used to be our shepherd. You guided us. You took care of us. You fulfilled any of our needs. And so what we're asking for Hashem here again is the same way you saved us in the past, I daven to you that you save us again in the present and in the future. Pasuk 4, here you come to the refrain, the pizmon. Elohim hashivenu, excuse me. Hashem, right, restore us. Ve'er panecha v'nivashea, bestow your light, show your favor upon us, and may we be delivered. That is section number one. Section number two, Pasuk 5. Adonai Elohim Tzvaot, Ad Matai Ashanta Betfilas Amecha. How long, Ashanta here means, how long are you going to be angry towards the prayers of your people? Again, remember we said the second section is Ad Matai. It's like a complaint against Hashem. Hashem, how long are you going to take this? Right? Ha'chaltem lechem dima v'tashkemo b'dimos shalish. What have you fed us, Hashem? You fed us the bread of tears, and you've let us drink enormous. Shalish here is a measurement. It's a significant measurement. You've fed us, you've given us to drink an enormous amount of tears. The Malbim points out that because of all our suffering and because of all our indignation, what are we eating? We're eating bread of tears, bread of misery, right? Tasimenu, Madon l'shcheinenu, you made us at strife, fighting with our neighbors. Ve'oivenu yilagu lamo, and our enemies are mocking us at will. The Malbim here says, who are we talking about? We're talking about Sanballat and Tuvia. We're talking about those enemies in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, who hated us and who mocked us and who tried so desperately to stop the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. And now we come to that refrain again, Elohim Tzvaot. Again, you notice that extra word, Hashivenu ve'er panecha v'nivashaya. Show us your favor and allow us to be delivered. That is section number two. Section number three, if you recall, was that parable. It was a mashal. We are compared to a grapevine. And this is where you get into somewhat of the more poetic language. Gefen mimitzrayim tasia, which means you plucked up a vine. Again, we are the vine. You plucked up a vine from Mitzrayim. Tigaresh goyim vatita'eah. You expelled all the nations we're talking about from the land of Israel, and you planted that grapevine in the land of Israel. We being the grapevine. You planted us in the land of Israel. Says Rav Hirsch, out of all the imagery, why specifically are the Jewish people referred to over here as grapevine? What is the significance of Geffen? So Rav Hirsch offers two suggestions. Says Rav Hirsch, number one, is that a grapevine is only significant if it presents grapes, right? In other words, if it produces grapes. If a grapevine doesn't produce grapes, it is essentially useless. Says Rav Hirsch, he explains that the vine can be the noblest among all the plants if it brings forth the fruit expected of it. Without its fruit, however, it would be quite worthless, for its wood alone would have no use whatsoever. So the grapevine is only important if it produces grapes. If it doesn't produce grapes, it's utterly worthless to us. So too Israel is the noblest and most blessed amongst the nations, provided that it fulfills its purpose. Right? The same way the grapevine is only important if it produces grapes, we, the Jewish people, are only, important or only at our noblest when we are doing our purpose, when we are fulfilling our mission, our mandate. However, if Israel should become unfaithful to its calling, it will sink far below all the other nations and will be of no use or value whatsoever. So interpretation number one, says Rav Hirsch, is that just as a grapevine is only useful in as much as it produces the grapes, so too we, the Jewish people, are only useful as in as much as we fulfill our mission and our mandate. Then Rav Hirsch comes along and says, I'll give you another interpretation. And this again, Lamnatzeach al Hagat, Gitis. We've referred to this a long time. The word Gat, many chapters of Tehillim, referred to as Gat, as referred to as Gitit, which is the wine press. And Rav Hirsch, in numerous places so far, has explained why do we refer to it as a wine press? Why are the Jewish people referred to as the wine press? He explains that the same way when you crush those grapes, so what you're doing is you're beating them down, you're trampling on them. Think of that episode of I Love Lucy when they're, you know, they roll up their pants and they're trampling on the grapes and they're stomping on the grapes. So in the moment, if you're a grape, are you miserable? You better bet your bottom dollar that you're miserable as a grape right then. But what emerges from those trampled grapes? This delicious, fine, sumptuous wine. Right? That, says Rav Hirsch, is the representation of the Jewish people. He says, our sages point out that the fruit of the vine is the most crushed and abused among the fruits. Right? The grapevine is trampled, it's stomped, it's, right? But this very abuse serves to ennoble it. And finally, he who has pressed and abused it overpowered by its strength. Right? So the Jewish people, says Rav Hirsch, are referred to as a grapevine because even though in the moment we're being abused, we emerge that much more refined, that much more ennobled, that much better in the long run. Okay, so with that backdrop, right? Gefen mimitzrayim tatsi Hashem, you plucked this grapevine out of Mitzrayim. Tigaresh goyim v'tata'eh, you got rid of the nations of the world. You planted us in the land of Israel. Panisa lefaneha v'tashresh sharsheha v'timalei haaretz What have you done? You cleared a place for it. Now, you gave us a land. And what happens? V'tashrei sharsheha. It took root in that land. And over time, what happens to a root? It spreads. Its tentacles spread all over the place. We filled the land. Kasoi harim chsila v'anfea arzeel. We became so great that the mountains were covered by its shade. And cedars by its, again, by its leaves. Tishalach kitzireh adyam ve'alnar yom koseha. So its branches reach the sea. Its shoots reach the river. In other words, again, you envision from these small roots, just it grows and 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 it grows. And so therefore we say to Hashem, if that's the case, lama paratzta gedereha ve'aruha kol ovrei darech. Hashem, we were so strong. So lama paratzta gedereha, we know this, right, from Ma'osor. Right, Yevanim nikbitzu alai, ufartzu chomos migdalai. Right, Hashem, why did you breach our walls? So that anyone who walked by can pluck at it. Right, walls are there to protect. And as long as the walls are there, people can't just pluck from my fruit. But if the walls disappear, then I have no protection. I have no privacy. Anyone who wants can walk by and take from my fruit. And obviously that's the symbol for the nations of the world. That once Hashem no longer protected us, so any of the nations of the world were able to come, and they were able to pluck away at us. And they were able to oppress us and persecute us. So lama paratzta gedere Hashem, why did you allow this to happen? Pasuk 14, yicharsemena chazir miyar veziv sadei yirena. Again, various forms of being attacked. That what that the wild boars are going to eat away at it. And creatures of the field are going to feed on it. Why did you allow this to happen? And so therefore we look at Hashem, we say, Elokim tzvakos, shuvna habein mishamayim ure'eh. Ufekod gefen zot. We say, Hashem, look down from heaven and take note of this vine. Who's saying this? I think it's Avram Fried has a song about this, right? I think Avram Fried has a song about this. Vechana sher nata yeminecha ve'albeini matzelach, right? The stock that you planted by your right hand, the stem that you have taken as your own, right? In other words, we're saying to Hashem, Hashem, look down on this tree, on these vines, again, on your Jewish people that have been plucked, that no longer have your protection. And what do we want you to do? Right? We want you to look down on the stock. Again, we being the stock that you planted with your right hand and the stem that you have taken on your own. Again, all talking about the Jewish people. And what about it? Because, Pasuk 17, Srufa ba'ish kesucha, migaras panecha yovedu. Right? Because it has been burned by fire. It's been cut down and it's perishing because of you. In other words, Hashem, because you removed your protection. So what's the most dangerous thing to a grapevine? Ask those in Napa Valley, right? What's the most dangerous thing to a grapevine is fire. Hashem, you allowed fire to consume it. And so therefore we say to Hashem, Tihi yadcha alish minecha al ben adam imatzte lach velo nasog mimecha techayenu v'shimcha nikra. Hashem, grant help to your people. Al ishi minecha, ishi here being us, right? The people of your right hand, and those your chosen people, right? Grant us help. Tihi yadcha. In other words, give us a helping hand. Velo nasog mimecha. Don't turn away from us. Nasog, the Mitzvah Siyam points out, is inyan hachzara. Don't turn away from us, but rather techayenu, right? Give us life. Uveshimcha nikra. And what will we do with that life? We will call out to you. In other words, we'll praise you, Hashem. And lastly, that final pasuk, Adonai Elohim Tzvahos Hashivenu Ha'er Panecha V'Nivashea, shine your light on us and you will save us. And so again, this chapter of Tehillim is broken up into three parts, right? It's a call to Hashem. It's a complaint against Hashem until when? And ultimately, it's that imagery of us as the grapevine, saying that Hashem, you've given us success in the past. You plucked us out of Egypt. You brought us to the land of Israel. But now we're being destroyed. We're being burned. All the nations are coming. They're able to pluck away at us. And so we end up with a tefillah to Hashem. Hashem, restore your security over us, your watchful eye over us, your protection over us, so that we can once again flourish. I think it's a magnificent chapter about exile. It's a magnificent chapter about wanting to return us to the land of Israel, wanting Hashem's divine providence on us once again. And I think it obviously has, even though I don't actually see a reference to Hanukkah at all, but I think it has a lot to do with Hanukkah, right? Hanukkah is about exile. Hanukkah is about the nations of the world trying to come away and slowly gnaw it away at our Jewishness and our Jewish values and our Jewish traditions, right? Hanukkah is about exile. And so this is a tefillah about exile. Also can't be more timely because we're in the Parshios of the Shvatim, right? And while we're reading about the bifurcation of the Shvatim or the infighting of the Shvatim, ultimately what we yearn for and we hope for is for that reunification to enable us to bring Mashiach. I'll share with you one last idea, and this is from the Sefer that I've read with the Bir Chasidus on Tehillim. So first of all, he says, if you think about the Gefen, right, the grape, he says, which are the choicest of the grapes? It's those that are lowest to the ground. And therefore, he says with us also that the choicest of the Jews are the Jews that are the lowest. In other words, not that we don't think of ourselves as a lot, but that we're low in the fact that we think of ourselves as lowly, right? We think of ourselves as lowly. And as we don't have arrogance, we have humility. That's ultimately what Hashem is looking for. But here's the idea. This refrain that keeps on coming up over and over again. Ha'er panecha v'nivashea. Shine your light on us and save us. Those are really two different things, right? Hashem can shine his light on us and we could still not be saved. Hashem can save us and we could still not shine our light on him. So for example, picture imagery of a child, right? If a child is going through a difficult time, you can save the child, right? Let's say a child rebels against you, goes off on his own and then finds himself in a difficult situation. You can save that child, but that doesn't mean that you're happy with the child. So you can be v'nevasheya, but it doesn't mean that you're going to have ha'aras panim. It doesn't mean you're going to shine your light on that child. On the other hand, a child can be in a very different, difficult situation where you're going to shine your light on him, but you might not be in a position to save him. He might be halfway around the world. He might be in college, right? You can't always come to your children's help. So what are these two words, right, of ha'er panecha v'nevasheya? So explains the Tzidkas HaTzadik, of Tzadik HaKohen, of Lublin. He says, Kasher Hashem Yisbarach Meir Panav L'Adam. When Hashem shines his light on a human being, when Hashem gives us a glimpse into his divine providence, Hainu Shemeir Belibo Amitus Hashem Yisbarach, when Hashem places in our heart the truthfulness, when he lights up the truthfulness of his existence, Echu be'emes melo kol ha'aretz kvodo, how Hashem really fills the entire world. Ve'efes zulaso klal, and that there's nothing in this world absent of Hashem. So when we see all of this, right, when we feel it, when Hashem shines that light in our souls, zehu kvar nosha b'yeshua shlema, that is the only redemption you and I need. Ki ma'at mina or doche harbe mina choshech, because just a little bit of light can get rid of a lot of darkness. V'kasher nichnas or babayis, when we let a little bit of light into the house, harei achoshech mistalik menu, then the darkness leaves altogether. And so, the salvation is the light. They are one in the same. What you and I crave more than anything in the world is to feel that light of Hashem. That so much of this world is us clawing away in darkness. Think about the imagery that the Mesillas Yesharim uses of a person being in a labyrinth. In the same way, when you're in a labyrinth, you have no idea where you're going and you're lost and you're discombobulated and disoriented. But there's the guy in the watchtower up at top who always knows where you are and where you're going and the way to get out. And while you can't see that path, he can always see that path. And the more you turn to him, the more chances you are actually getting out of that labyrinth. That's how we are in this world, right? This world is dark. It's been darkened by nature. That's why the word olam is from the word he'olam. It's missing, right? It's dark. Hashem is absent from this world, okay? And that's what makes this world dark for us. And we don't always know the correct path, and we don't always know what to do, and we don't always know where we should head and how we should conduct ourselves. And so what we yearn for more than anything else is ha'er panecha, Hashem, give me that light. Light up my eyesight enough, light up my soul enough to be able to feel you, to be able to feel Malochol Aretz Kivodo, that you permeate every aspect of the world, to be able to feel that Ve'efes Zula, so that there's no existent irrespective of you in this world, Hashem. And when I feel that clarity, when I feel that light in my life, Dayenu, that is the salvation. Everything else is just icing on the cake. And so I thought from Rav Tzadok HaKohen, that was really a beautiful idea, ties very much into the holiday of Hanukkah, that when you look at those candles, what are we davening for? We're davening that the same way we light the candles in this world, Hashem should light our candle, that Hashem should illuminate our lives, that we should no longer feel the darkness around us, but we should see with clarity and certainty the truth of Hashem's existence, the truth of how we should conduct ourselves, the truth of what it means to be the chosen people. That is what it means. Ha'er panecha, Hashem, please give us that light. Vini vashea, in that light alone is all the salvation that we crave for. It's all the salvation that we yearn for. So we saw a magnificent chapter of Tehillim today. We saw a chapter of Tehillim about exile. We got to review a little bit about the story of Ezra and Nehemiah. We obviously tied it into Hanukkah, the notion of light, the notion of salvation, the notion of seeing with clarity Hashem's existence in this world and our relationship with Him. And hopefully, again, I don't know that this was a particularly popular chapter previously, but hopefully now we'll have renewed meaning for all of us. We can say it with a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose, and ultimately it will give us a deeper and more meaningful relationship with Hashem. I want to wish everyone a beautiful week, a Chag Kasher V'Sameach, I'm just joking, a Chanukah Sameach, a Freilich in Chanukah, and again, tonight is Zos Chanukah, the culmination of the eight, right? Seven is nature, eight is beyond nature. And that's what makes that eighth day of Chanukah so significant, is it represents our unique relationship.